Okay, so just to recap for the people who came in a little bit later, if it wasn't immediately apparent what our question is this morning, we started by noting that often when one gets into the depths of studying Torah, the depths of studying Halakha, the question arises, why is it that Halakha seems to be so preoccupied with the details, with the minutiae, something that legal theorists would call legal formals? And I said we were going to look at three cases. Nobody got to three cases, so don't feel bad. But three different cases that are sort of paradigmatic of the issue and raise the difficulties that come along with this type of approach to a legal system. And ultimately, where I'd like to take you by the time we finish is to perhaps understand why it is that Halakha is structured this way, and hopefully to a greater appreciation, a deeper appreciation for the Halakhic system. So I started you off in the case Meinyanei D'Yoma from the Halakha of the day, of the time period, the case of the 35-foot menorah. So sometimes, you know, they say that the most interesting things that you find in the book are the white spaces. And I think that's particularly true when it comes to this particular halakha and this particular braisa. I know there was a discussion over here about the rift and why I brought the rift in this discussion when the rift looks almost exactly like the braisa does, although thank you, Dr. Jacobson, for pointing out that it's not exactly the same. But it does look almost exactly the same, and so the question arises, why did I put it in there? And the answer is because the white space in both of them is actually exactly the same. What do I mean? The Braisa tells us that a Nirchanimo cannot be put, Yoser Me'esrinama, cannot be put higher than 20 Amma. And it says because it's like Sukkah, and Mavoi, and I gave you the Gemara in Sukkah that explains why it is that a Sukkah cannot be more than 20 Amos. And I also gave you Rashi, and Rashi tells us that we follow, that the Halakha in Hanukkah is following that opinion in Sukkah, which says that we cannot be higher than 20 Amos. Why not? Why can't it be higher than 20 Amos? Because
not in your vision.
It's not in your field of vision. Because it's not, you can't see more than 35 feet 5 inches, 5.04 inches. It's not in your field of vision. Now, what I thought was fascinating though is that the Braisa never said it. The Braisa says it very simply, that you cannot make it more than 20 amos. It doesn't say anything about a reason. It's Rashi, some 600 years later, 700 years later, who comes and tells you, here's the reason. And in fact, when the Rif codifies this halakha, he doesn't find the need to tell you the reason either. 20 amos, that's the halakha. And in fact, when the Shulchan Aruch codifies it, same thing. No reason given. The Mishnah Berurah, some 500 years after the Shulchan Aruch, lets you know, because of Rashi, you can't put it more than 20 amos because the field of vision doesn't extend there. But the halakha itself, in its core, feels no need to tell you a reason. 20 amos, end of story. And so our question this morning is why? Why is it that halakha is articulated in this type of way? In fact, wouldn't it be better if the halakha said, put your near Hanukkah in a place where people can see it? Because after all, if that is the motivation behind the law, if the idea is, as Rashi points out, that people can see and therefore you have Persuma Denisa, so right, put the near Hanukkah in a place where it's visible. End of story. 20 hours? Why? This type of articulation of law can lead to some pretty interesting and sometimes pretty difficult types of results. I remember very vividly one morning when I was teaching at YU, I walked into the door of First Hall and I was greeted by commandos. literally, huge men in these sort of black protective suits with massive machine guns on their backs. And I asked somebody, I said, what's going on? And they said, oh, you didn't know? The Cardinals are coming. So I'm thinking to myself, my gosh, I know that professional athletes like have a lot of security these days, but this is a little bit of overkill. And then it took me a few minutes after I got into my office, spoke to somebody else, and don't know me, it wasn't those kind of Cardinals, right? It was the other kind of Cardinal, right? The ones that work for the Catholic Church, not for Major League Baseball. They were coming to visit Yeshiva University to learn about what happens in Yeshiva University. And so I was just picturing to myself, can you imagine if this group of Cardinals enters into the Beit Midrash one day, and they're walking around, and somebody's leading them on a tour, and they're like, so what are you learning today? Oh, we're learning about the proper height for a menorah. Fascinating. Well, how high does a menorah have to be? Well, it can't be higher than 35 feet, 5.04 inches. Interesting. Why? Because you can't see higher than 35 feet and 5.04 inches. Fascinating. Didn't know that. But yeah, what's this group over here? Well, this group over here is learning, but what if I have the question is really whether the menorah itself has to be less than 35 feet, 5.04 inches, or whether the candle itself, the candle, extends to 35 feet, 7.04 inches. Can you see that? Fascinating. Oh, wait a minute, we're not done yet, because there's a group over here. Now, they're learning something really interesting. And here's the piece they're learning. If I have a menorah that's 34 feet, 5.04 inches, and I have a candle that's exactly 1 foot tall, and the candle's going to burn for more than the requisite number amount of time that a candle is supposed to burn for, so then I light the wick, which is technically 0.02 inches higher than it's supposed to be, but about 30 seconds after I light it, now the light becomes lower and inside the amount that it's supposed to be. Can you see that? It sounds absurd! Right? It sounds absurd! And the truth of the matter is that any time we have a formalistic articulation of law, these kinds of things happen. It opens it up when we get into the minutiae to find cases where it just doesn't seem like you're actually talking about the reason behind the law. In fact, the Rambam writes this clearly, explicitly, this morning of the He writes that if you want to talk about reasons behind the law, you can only talk about the laws in general. Once you get to the level of prat, of that kind of detail, you can't talk about the reason anymore. It's sort of like saying, is it really true that going 65.01 miles per hour is unsafe, but going 64.9 miles per hour is safe? God. But hopefully, as you saw, in case two, it gets even worse. That is, we can create cases where the reason behind the law actually is at odds with the formalistic articulation of the law. We can actually construct a case where the two are at cross purposes. Right? So if the case, and I hope you can understand my artistic rendering here, case number two. Right? But what I was trying to show is as follows. I've got a house that it's a compound. Right? It is surrounded by really high fences on all sides. Fences that extend well beyond 40-foot fences around my house. There's nobody coming in and out of my house. But right on the other side is a busy street. Lots of traffic. Rashi told us that the reason for the prohibition of Esri Mama is because Yosef and Esri Mama were shoulder by Eina, the light of Esri Mama, Denisa, over 20 amos, nobody sees it. And there's no pursuit of Denisa. Well, in this case, if you put it under 20 amos, nobody's going to see it. In fact, the only chance you have of somebody seeing it is to put it more than 20 amos. So what's the halacha? What do I do? The Gemara was, price was clear, didn't even mention anything about a reason. It just said, no more than 20 amos. Taking that price at face value, taking the ring at face value, taking the Gemara at face value, the answer should be no. I can't put it over 20 amos. I just can't. The halacha says no. But if what's really going on is there's a reason behind it, well then absolutely, of course, I've got to put it higher than 20 amos, or else nobody will see it. That was case number one. We're going to come back to the case of some Pennsylvania code in just a little while. Case number two, I know some of the groups got started here. For those who didn't, the case is written out clearly on page four. It goes something like this. Let's look at it together on top of page four. The Gemara says as follows. Kol v'sarobai, shekol v'fal olamai. The requisite amount of water that has to be in the mikvah is such that one's entire body can be immersed in it. The kamei. And so how much is that? Ama b'rom yimam amos v'shiru chachamim me mikvah mem seya. It's a square cubit to the height of 3 cubits, which the sages have estimated to be 40 seya. So, in this case, different than the case of the menorah, the Gemara actually starts with the reason. Starts with the objective of the law. The objective is, one must be totally immersed in the water. Now, once we have that objective, the Chachamim came along and said, how much would that be? That would be, we're estimating, based on the average height of human beings, as we know that, 40 seya should be enough for people to totally immerse. So here's my question. My question is, a woman is converting into Judaism. And she goes through the whole process, and she does everything in Kehalah. She goes to the mikvah as the final piece of the conversion process. Everything is fine and dandy. She goes on, she meets a nice Jewish boy, they get married, they have a family, they have kids, they have grandkids. And then some 25 years later, some 30 years later, they learn that the mikvah that she immersed in actually had only 39 seya. Now, what we do know, and as everybody in the who reads the United States press today knows, there are people who witness immersion into the water. So we had witnesses there who can attest to the fact that she was totally immersed. She was totally immersed. She did what the halacha said. She was called the son of the night. She was totally immersed, but it wasn't 40 seya. Now we get a big question. Is she Jewish? Are her kids Jewish? Are her grandkids Jewish? Big question. All depends, right, on this question, on do we go after the reasoning of the law, which in this case is absolutely clear, or do we go after the shiur, the specific prescribed measurement given to us by the rabbis. Now, what makes things even more complicated is that in this case, it seems to be very clear that the reasoning trumps the measurement. That the reasoning is you should be totally immersed, and the rabbis then came and said, how much is that? It's 40 seya. So if you have a case where, again, l'chatchila, ab initio, when you're starting, absolutely it should be 40 seya. But if it wasn't, as long as she was totally immersed, you would say fine. Except that we have another one that tells us those 40 seya, that measurement, right? All other measurements, this was not things that the rabbis made up. The Gemara says that all shiuri, all measurements, are halacha l'moshe nisya. This comes to us from Sinai. It's not something that I'm asking about. In fact, the Rambam codifies it as such. All these measurements come from Sinai. And in fact, you have a response on the bottom there, in the Shulchan Rukosh, which deals with exactly this question. And if you look at the last line, it says, Nimzir Lamdin, the Arbayim Seyad Tar Torah, the Lord came of the Rabbanim of Yahya's Nachbayim of the Oraisa, that 40 seya is the oraisa, it is not rabbinic, it comes from God at Sinai, and so a woman who immersed in 39 Sinai, even though she was completely covered, according to the Rivash at least, would not be Jewish. Now, come on. How could that be?
The case that nobody got to.
The case that may be the most fun. The case of Rabbi Yehuda. It's an innocent looking case, one that doesn't look terribly relevant until we get a little bit into the story that's there in the Gemara. The case is as follows. Everybody, of course, knows what a dove cote is, right? Right. As we fall down in our backyard. And it was the type of pen or, dove cote that was used to as a place for nesting for carrier pigeons. Carrier pigeons were very, very valuable in that world, and this is where they would come home, right, to nest. So the case in the Gemara is, if I find a pigeon on the ground, do I consider to be something I can pick up and take, assuming it has no markings on it that signify its owner, or should I be assuming that this belongs to somebody and I have to return it? Now, the Gemara immediately qualifies our case and says, listen, we're not talking about pigeons that fly, right? Because that's a much more complex question. We're talking about baby pigeons. Baby pigeons don't fly, they waddle. And we're talking about a case of a little baby pigeon who fell out of the dove cote. What if they started waddling? And I'm walking along, and I see, cute little thing on the ground. Can I keep it? Or do I have to return it? And so the Gemara says the Chazal, the Mishnah says, that if I find it within 50 amos of a dove cote, I've got to assume it belongs to the owner of that dove cote. I may not keep it for myself. I must return it. If I find it outside of 50 amos perimeter from that dove cote, I can assume that I can take it. Why? Because pigeons can't waddle more than 50 amos from a dove cote. That's the answer given by the Gemara. Now, Rabbi Yehuda has a question. Now, by the way, I didn't give you all the sources here, because as it is, I gave you probably too many. But Rabbi Yehuda had lots of questions. It's throughout Shas. Rabbi Yehuda is a really interesting character, and his questions are often of a similar nature. But only one time does he give himself quite the trouble, and it may be because this was like the fifth or sixth question of this type, right? But only here do we see this type of reaction. Rabbi asks the following question. He says, Rabbi, what if I'm walking around along the street and I find a cute little pigeon on the ground, and I take out my tape measure, and I measure from where it is to the dove cote, and lo and behold, you know what I find? 1 foot of a pigeon is inside the yards. And 1 foot of a pigeon is outside 50 amos. Rabbi, what do I do? And you know what they said? Get out of here! That was their response. They threw him out of the issue. Why?
Are you ready? It's a klutz kasha.
Huh?
It's a klutz kasha.
Meaning what? It's a klutz kasha. Meaning what?
It's made up in some ridiculous set of circumstances, like this doesn't appear many other times in the Gemara.
Right. It's no different than the rest of Shas, by the way.
Unrealistic, so he was just being a pain in the ass.
Okay, so Rashi says, like Jerome, that it's a totally hypothetical case that could never happen, right? And others say, also like Jerome, that, but isn't the rest of the Gemara like that too? In fact, right, the question is even stronger because the Mishnah itself, right, look back up at the Mishnah on top of page 5. What does the last line of the Mishnah say? If it is exactly midway, they must share it. The case is actually there in the Mishnah. It's pretty much there. So, what was wrong with what Rabbi Yehuda did? Or let me ask it differently. If the Prima Gadda was asking this question, or the Prima Gadda was in the yeshiva of Rabbi Yehuda and asked the question, so you told me that a menorah has to be 30 can't be higher than 35 feet, 5.04 inches. Well, what if 34 feet and 5.04 inches, but it's got a candle that's a foot tall, so what happens then? Better yet, the case that I brought you from the Kreuzenberger Rav, the case where the wick is a little bit above, but there's enough in the candle to make the lifter enough, and the minute that the light gets right up down underneath, are we going to throw it out of the yeshiva too? I mean, isn't he doing this? Isn't that just as, just, I mean, a 35-foot menorah, we never saw it. Chabad has not 35-foot menorahs. I never saw such a high menorah before. Right? In the case of a 35-foot menorah or a 34-foot menorah with exactly enough and the candles of the wick is exactly above and once the light comes underneath, throw them out of the yeshiva. No? Why don't we throw them out?
No, there's a difference. The reference to midway is when it's between two different dovecotes.
Yeah.
And his question is about if you are 50 cubits away from the one, and in the case of the midway, there is an exact midpoint between the two, whereas this estimate of how far the bird can walk is kind of like it's not an exact figure to begin with. I mean, it's put as one, but it's explained as being a distance that a bird can walk, which is, you know, not the same as a midpoint between two physical objects.
And why then would Rabbi Yirmiyah's question be worse? Why throw him out for questioning that? In fact, it would seem to be, right, that's a better question. It's kind of an imprecise thing to begin with. So I'm asking the question of what happens when I can't, when I really don't know. So why throw him out? Okay. All right. So let me share with you the roof, which is on the set. And from there, I'm going to try and bring this together, at least look at two different approaches to trying to understand. The Ritva on page 7 begins with Rashi. Rashi says pretty much what Jerome said, or at least it's the way that Tosfos and the Ritva understand Rashi, is that why was Rav Yirmiyah thrown out? He was thrown out because of, we raised a totally implausible case. He was being matriarch, he was that student who just kept getting us off topic, right? And enough is enough already. We're trying to cover some ground here. Get out of here, right? And let us move on. Says the Ritva, though, he doesn't see it quite that way. So we're to the second line of the Ritva. Now, enough of the prepares for being time. The halav mishum tzmi. Ela kevan da amur rabbanan she'in medada yotzer mechamishim ama. I'm sorry, Yosem Yichamishim. Lo havale lemibay tu mi. Din zauzel de shi'ure de rabbana. De chol shi'ure chachami kachu. De kemen she yatsa mechamishim ama. Sorry, de kemen she yatsa klal mechamishim ama yatsa. Yatsa mi din midada. De kam de taras mafriyah. Mas nisi in lefisha kol tov chamishim ama. Says the Ritva as follows. He says, listen. This is not about a case, a hypothetical. It's not about. The beauty was saying something much deeper. He was being mezalzel d'shiure chachamim. He was saying something. He was attacking the system as a whole. He was attacking the system. He was asking something that ultimately could make the whole thing crumble. And for that, he was thrown out. Because all shiurim are this way, says the Ritva. All shiurim, all measurements in the Torah are this way. Whether it's our matzah that we eat, or the wine that we drink, or it's the dove goat, or it's the chanukiah. All shiurim are this way. And what Rabbi Yirmiyah was doing was striking at the heart of the Torah's system, which is at its heart a formalistic system. We do this. We have really precise measures, and yes, it's true. It's true that in its most detail, in its greatest minutia, any formalistic system is going to be open to that kind of critique. Any system, whether it's the speed limit, your taxes, or anything else that's stated in a formalistic fashion, when you get down to that, you've got a pigeon with one foot on either side, yeah, it's going to be absurd. That's the way any type of legal system that is stated in this way works. But the Chachamim seem to be saying, we want it that way. We need it that way. The Torah was intended that way. And so our question is why? Two more sources. Can I ask some of our fellows to help? He just two approaches slightly different from one another. And why it is that halacha in general is stated in such a way, why this was important, and hence why it was that Rabbi Yirmiyahu was asking a question that needed a strong and emphatic response. First, Justice Moshe Silberg, who was the assistant, I think, or the deputy chief justice in the Israeli High Court for many, many years, and was widely considered one of the real experts in Mishpat Ivri, in Jewish law, for quite some time in the 20th century. Says Justice Moshe Silberg as follows: Jewish jurisprudence, if you may say so, is a jurisprudence which does not depend on judges. The function of the law is not to prescribe for the judge how to decide. It prescribes for the person how to conduct his life. Quote number two. If the goal of the legislator, if the ideal toward which he aspires is not to resolve post-facto conflicts between man and man, but to provide in the first place moral guidance for each person, then the first consideration of precision and clarity will prevail, and the inevitable result is legal formalism, says Justice Silberg as follows. The case, the two laws that I gave you, from the PA Code. Two active laws on the books today. One about the speed limit, the other about the due diligence a pharmacist has to do when a prescription is called in. One is stated in an extremely formalistic fashion. Which one is that? The speed limit tells you exactly how fast you can drive, depending on the street, depending on where you are in the given circumstances. The second one uses phrases like good faith effort and reasonable. That is not a formalistic articulation of law. And says Justice Silberg, the difference between the two, and I heard really good suggestions in your groups as to why these two are stated very differently, says Justice Silberg, they're written for different audiences. Now, to him, though, the audience is not a difference between sort of the common people and the professional, which is definitely an argument that can be made. He sees it differently. He sees that one is written for people, for the masses, and the other is written for judges. That is, a formalistic fashion, a formalistically articulated law is one that's supposed to be a conduct of behavior. It tells you what to do. It tells you and me what to do every day when we get behind and when we get into our car and we start driving. One that is stated in without that type of formulation is one that's written for judges to let judges, instruction to a judge. If you have a case where there's an accusation against a pharmacist, that they were not careful enough, so now it's the judge's responsibility to determine whether this was reasonable or not, whether this was a good faith effort or not. And so says Justice Silberg, halacha is 100% in the first category. Halacha is not about what are not rules for judges to interpret. They're rules for us to conduct our behavior. I want to be careful. Justice Silberg is not saying, he mentions explicitly, that there's no room for a rabbi and there's no room for a psak. And we should absolutely make it clear that it's a problem in today's world that we don't ask enough when there are hard cases of halacha. But the truth of the matter is that halacha is intended for you and me. It's intended to tell us what we do when we get up in the morning, how to wash our hands, how to get dressed, how to eat, how to daven. It's intended for us. It's a code of behavior. It's a code of conduct. It's not instructions for our judge to determine ex post facto and what actually happened in this case. Were you reasonable in the way you washed your hands? Did you eat enough ex post facto to make a profit? No! It's instructions for us proactively. And if that's the case, then by definition, halakha has to be stated in a formalistic fashion. And yes, by definition, when one does so, it leads to certain absurdities right on the other edges of that actual precise measurement. Of course it does. But when seen in the larger context, we want it that way. Because it's intended for us, and it's not intended for judges. You know, Soloveitchik, and I only noticed this afterwards, that I didn't write Rabbi Dr. Josephine Soloveitchik on the sheet, and I certainly should have. But Soloveitchik has a slightly different spin on this same idea. And his writing, of course, which here is, of course, in translation, but is difficult and it's dense. Let's try to read it together, and then I'm trying to summarize what I think it's saying and how it impacts this question. A subjective religiosity cannot endure. And all of those tendencies to transform the religious act into pure subjectivity negate all corporeality and all sensation religious life, and they give it to a pure and abstract world, whether it's in reading or drinking, the religious individuals sitting with their crowns on their heads and enjoying their own inner experiences, their own tempestuousness, heaven-storming spirits, their own hidden longings and mysterious yearnings will in the end prove null and void. The psychic power of religion, yes, I had to look it up too. The psychic power of religion that seizes hold of man, that subjects and dominates him, is in force only when the religion is a concrete religion. A religion of the life of the senses in which there is sight, smell, and touch. A religion in which a man of flesh and blood can feel with all of his senses, sinews, and organs, with his entire being. A sensuous religion which cognitive man will encounter in a very palpable way wherever he may go. A subjective religiosity comprised of spiritual moods, of emotions and affections, of outlooks and desires, will never be blessed with success. Quote number two. The halakha, which was given to us from Sinai, is the objectification of religion in clear and determinate forms, in precise and authoritative laws, and in definite principles. It translates subjectivity into objectivity, the amorphous flow of religious experience into a fixed pattern of lawfulness. What does Rav Soloveitchik say? I believe that what Rav Soloveitchik is saying is as follows. Soloveitchik is saying that halakha is the case in which we place religion, the emotion, the power, the meaning of religion comes, and it comes, we place it in a rather rigid case, because if we don't, in his words, it cannot succeed. It cannot succeed. Why? Because left to our own devices to determine how we should do the halakha depending on how we feel today puts us in a precarious place. Because one day we're going to feel great religiously, and the next day, not so much. One day we're going to feel like going lifting the shuras adin over and above in our halakha service, and the next day, not so much. So one day we'll get up and we'll daven shacharis at 4:53 in the morning, and the next day, okay, 2:35 in the afternoon. Says Rav Soloveitchik, and the key word here, I think, is that it won't be successful. And I need to think about what does it mean for a religion to be successful or not. I would like to suggest that what Rav Soloveitchik means by that is more than just whether we are going to succeed in carrying out the halakha, which I believe is where Justice Silberg is coming from. And I think he means more than that. I think he means, will our halakha, will our religion succeed in carrying from generation to generation? Or will it die out? Because it's subjected to the whims of our particular emotions, and today we feel like doing it this way, and today we feel like doing it that way, and our children look at that, and quite honestly, they're not feeling what you're feeling. They're seeing what you're doing, but they're not feeling what you're feeling. And so today it seems like a mishmash. It seems like something which is absurd. Right? Today it looks one way. Today you are going to shul. Tomorrow I don't go to shul. Right? Tomorrow I do this. Tomorrow I don't do that. That is a prescription for something which is going to die out. As genuine as it might be, as sincere as the feelings behind it might be, at the end of the day, unless it's fixed in some sort of tight case that I can now take and hand to the next generation, this is how we do it. Says of Soloveitchik, it's bound to fall apart. And so I want to suggest to you the following. I want to suggest that number one, Justice Silberman and Soloveitchik are clearly not at odds with each other. Both of them are offering really important insight into why the formalistic articulation of halacha is critical, both to the way we perform halacha, that it should be something that I don't have to run to a judge to find out whether I did it right or I did it wrong. It's something that I can do day in, day out in every single piece of my life. And according to Soloveitchik, it's something which I can then pass on. It's something that will succeed. It's something that will outlive me. It has a concretized form, right, that then can be given over generation to generation. And I want to end by perhaps suggesting that difficult contradiction we saw with regard to the mikvah. But on the one hand, it seems like the Chachamim themselves made that shiur, that measurement up, based on the Torah, which says you have to have all of your flesh in the water, came along the rabbis and said, okay, that's 40 seah. That's 40 seah. They didn't seem like that was their tradition, that they knew that Moshe had been told 40 seah, and then generation after Moshe had been told 40 seah. That doesn't sound like what the Gemara itself said. And yet, we have another Gemara that says all of these shiurim are midaraisa. And in fact, we saw a shiur of Rivash, which says in the fictional case that I invented, that woman wouldn't be Jewish, because even though she's totally immersed in the water, there wasn't 40 seahs. How could that be? So I want to suggest, perhaps, that when the Gemara tells us that kol shiurim or halacha moshe Sinai, it doesn't mean that 40 seah was told to Moshe on Sinai. It doesn't mean that the content of the measurements was handed down generation to generation, but that there must be measurements is halacha l'Moshe Sinai. That our system will collapse if we do not have precision in the way in which we articulate our halachos, then the whole thing is going to fall down. So yes, as difficult as it might be in that case of a woman, she may have to do it over again. Not because there was something wrong with the particular act that she did, but like Rabbi Yirmiyahu was attacking the system as a whole. And if we don't hold it up in those hard cases, we put the whole system at risk. Because in order for it all to work, in order for it to guide our lives, day in and day out, in order for it to be something that's concrete that I can hand over generation to generation, the Torah must be articulated in this type of way, and that's why halacha places such an emphasis on details. That's how it's articulated in a way that we would call legal formalism. Thank you, everyone, for your time.